Okay, cool. Okay, thank you so much for having me again. Thank you for all of those who are here live and others who have listened over their different recordings, video, audio, and a special shout out this week to my parents who are watching live. Welcome and thanks for coming. So I want to start with a story that I think is the perfect segue between last week's topic, which we focused on kind of the topic of secrets, and our intention in this type of limud, this type of learning of matters that are more of a esoteric or spiritual nature. And then this week's topic, we're going to start talking about the actual process of creation as it's taught to us by our tradition. So the story is told about Rav Naftali of Rupshitz, that apparently he wore a certain type of pants that were unique. Apparently, I don't know exactly what the story is, but he wore a unique colored pants, and there was one chassid, as all good stories go, there was one chassid who had the chutzpah, the audacity to ask him, you know, he asked the Rebbe, what's the story with these pants? Why is there some reason behind it? Why this specific color? It was kind of an odd color, and the Rav Naftali of Rupshitz told him, I'll tell you why, but first you have to fast for 6 days to prepare yourself to be able to take this secret. So the young man fasted for 6 days and he prepared himself, and then he was told to go to the mikvah, and he had an intense week of preparation to find out the secret behind Rav Naftali of Rupshitz's pants. And so he went to Rav Naftali and he told him, okay, I'm ready. I fasted. I did all the mikvah preparation, the tefillah preparation, the tzedakah, everything you wanted me to do. So Rav Naftali takes him and says, okay, follow me. So he takes him to the back of a really kind of off the road house where there's like an entrance into a forest that nobody really knew about, no one goes to, and he took him deep into the forest, and then from there he took him and he found this kind of, there was this hut, and from there they got a key to go into this other place, and they went from one place to another and finally got into this really, you know, off the beaten track location after a series of going from one place to another. And he says, okay, here I can tell you, no one else can hear, no one else. He says, the reason that I wear these pants is because they're the cheapest ones in the marketplace. That's the secret. So there's many, many ideas behind this story, I think. On the simplest level, I think that what this story is actually teaching us is kind of a paradoxical joke about secrets. Because it's showing us the power of the secret. It's showing us how intrigued this young person became, simply because of the fact that the Rupshitzer set this up as being something so secretive. If you would have just told him straight out, it loses all its intrigue, but the secret becomes so intriguing just by nature of it being a secret. But then it becomes kind of paradoxical, because the secret that he ultimately reveals to him is nothing secretive at all. And what he's actually revealing to him is that, well, you know what? Sometimes in life, things don't have to always be a very big deal. Things don't always have to be something in a supernal realm of spiritual meaning. Things could be as simple as the fact that these were the cheapest ones in the marketplace. But I think there's another interpretation of the story that kind of adds another layer to what the Rupshitzer was doing there. And I think that what we look at today will allow us to see this story from another angle, and will be a segue between last week's concept of secrets and this week's opening topic on creation. So, without further ado, let's delve into it. So, if you learn any of these svarim that are in the tradition of Kabbalah, anything within Hasidus, and even outside of Hasidus, anything really that's within the tradition of within the Mesorah of Kabbalah, you'll see that creation of the world begins with the statement that Hashem needed to constrict himself, a concept that most of us are probably familiar with, that we've heard of, called Tzimtzum, that Hashem needed to constrict himself before creating the world. Because otherwise, there would not have been any room for creation to take place. So again, it seems offhand on a surface level, seems like a relatively straightforward and simple statement that in order for Hashem to create the world, in order for Hashem to for there to be space, for there to be anything besides for God, besides for Hashem, Hashem needed to constrict himself, to pull himself back, so that now there will be space for something else to be created that is not him. Okay? So this sounds relatively straightforward. This is the concept of tzimtzum. So again, Hashem needed to pull himself back, needed to constrict himself, needed to conceal himself, so that now there is this open area, this vacuum, this place that does not have that potency of godliness, so that there can be the creation of something else that can exist independent of God. But let's try to understand this a little bit more. Why did God need to constrict himself? Right? Like, meaning God can do what he can do all sorts of things. So what really was the problem? What was the problem that there couldn't be space for anything else, and therefore he needed to constrict himself? Because if we are careful in how we think about this, we remember that, of course, God is not physical. God doesn't take up actual space. Right? So what does it even mean that there needed to be space made for something else to exist? So again, on the simple level, God needed to pull himself back so that there can be space for something else to be created. But again, number one, why? Why couldn't God just create something else? Let just snap your proverbial fingers and let there be whatever God says there will be. And number two, we have to really understand this in a totally different way, because we're not talking about space in any sort of physical way. God does not take up physical space. And there doesn't even exist physical space before God creates anything. The concept of space and the concept of physicality don't exist. So what does it mean that Hashem had to pull himself back to create an empty space so that he can create something else? So to understand this, I think we need to take a step back and understand how the spiritual tradition within Yiddishkeit, whether you want to call that Kabbalah, mysticism, Hasidus, whatever you want to call it, but the spiritual tradition within Yiddishkeit understands creation. Because typically I think we think of creation as many talk about, a concept of yesh me'ayin, ex nihilo. So there is nothing besides God, there's nothing that exists, and Hashem somehow, in whatever way, makes something pop. Did I just get muted? Now I'm unmuted? Okay. Makes Hashem, Hashem out of nothing makes something pop into existence. All right? But within a spiritual understanding of creation, it's actually a little bit different than that. Hashem doesn't just make something pop out of nothingness into existence. Rather, creation is better termed emanation instead of creation. So all of creation is a process of emanation. And what this means, the simplest analogy for this, as we spoke about last week, no analogy will do full justice to this, but this is a helpful entryway into understanding creation from a spiritual perspective. The analogy that's so often used is the analogy of the sun giving off light. The sun creates, in a sense, light. The sun gives off light. But the sun is not making light pop out of nothingness, pop out of darkness. What the sun is doing is it is shining its own, it's shining light from within itself outwards. So there is light that is emanating out of the sun to create light in all the surrounding area. And this is the analogy that the Svarim give for Hashem's creation of the world. It's not that Hashem figuratively snapped his fingers and now something pops into existence. It's that Hashem radiates of his self. Hashem emanates of his self. He shines forward what he is, his light, as if, his energy, in a sense. And it's usually referred to in the Sfarim as light, as or. So Hashem is mashpia, his or. He's mazhir, his or. He emanates his light forward like the sun emanates rays of light. And those emanations of godly light become creation through a process that we're going to look at over the next few weeks. So again, creation is understood more as a process of emanation, of atzilus, of the sun giving off of its light, giving off of itself, shining forward. And now, with that understanding of how creation unfolds, we can go back to understand the problem that Kabbalah sets out to exist at the beginning of creation. Because if and why tzimtzum is essential and necessary. Because if creation is an act of God shining his self outwards, well, then when Hashem shines forward, when the light of the sun comes off of the sun, when that light emanates, what is going to exist now? Simply more godliness, more light of the sun. So if all Hashem were to do was to emanate his light outwards, was to be ma'atzil, was to shine, to radiate that light, then all that would exist would be more godliness. There would be no independent consciousness, no independent or individual existence of anything else. The only thing that would come from this process of creation is just more God. So God would just be shining godliness and it would just be all God. But then there would be no creation as we know it. So what Kabbalah is addressing is not a problem of physical space. When it talks about space in this context, it's talking about space for individuality, space of allowing there to be consciousness of independence. So the problem again is this, and now if we rewind the tapes to set out again what Kabbalah is saying here. What Kabbalah is teaching us is the following. In order for Hashem to create the world, a world in which, as we know it, there is independent individuality, there's multiplicity of beings, I am myself and you are you and we are independent beings, and I have a consciousness of being myself and you have a consciousness of being you, and I don't have a consciousness of being you and you don't have a consciousness of being me. And I don't have a consciousness of being God. I have to work on realizing that there's godliness, right? But that's not my natural state of being. So in order to get from God to a world in which we have all this individuality and all this consciousness of independence, in order for that to take place, God can't just radiate his light, because that wouldn't allow for that kind of individuality, that kind of independent consciousness. Because if all God were to do was to shine his light, it would just be more godliness. So in order for God to create or to emanate in a way that will allow for the beings that come into existence to experience themselves as being other than God, as being independent beings, he needed to first pull way back on how potent his godliness is, on how intense the godly presence is in those lights that will be emanated. So this is a little bit confusing, and we're not in person, so I can't, sometimes, you know, you get a feel for the room of how much people are grasping, but, you know, not in person, it's a little bit harder. So I apologize if I'm repeating myself too much, but I want to just make sure that I'm being clear. So I'm gonna try and repeat this again in a kind of straightforward way to the best of my ability. So here is, if you open Otros Chaim, a basic starting kind of safer on understanding Kabbalah of the Arizal, if you open almost any safer than Hasidus, you will come across the concept of Tzimtzum. Right? You will come across the concept that in order for creation to begin, there needed to be Hashem pulling himself back and constricting his presence in reality. What we're trying to do is understand what that means and why that's so. Like, why did Hashem actually need to constrict himself? What does it even mean to constrict himself? Because we're not talking about physical space. So what does that even mean? So what we're explaining is that creation from the perspective of Kabbalah is not an act of Hashem just saying, Yehi, whatever it is, Yehi, Rakia, and now the heavens pop into existence. Rather, the working analogy for us to use that we're provided with is an analogy of the sun giving off its light. So the same way that the sun shines its light, emanates its light outwards, so too Hashem emanates his own being, in whatever exact sense that means, Hashem emanates his own being, his own light, and that gives way to creation. But if Hashem would just do that in a straightforward way, what Kabbalah is identifying is there'd be a problem in the process. Because if Hashem were to just very simply shine his light forward, well, then there would just be more godliness. We would never arrive at the reality of me being me and you being you and neither of us being God. All we would arrive at is just more God. So how did Hashem's emanating his light allow for there to be a reality in which we experience individuality and independence from each other and from God? And so what Kabbalah is teaching is that in order for that to happen, Hashem had to constrict, had to conceal some of the intensity or the revelation or the potency of his presence. He had to create this space, not physical space, but this lack of godly consciousness, this lack, this place where there is a lack of realizing that light that is coming out is actually godly light. And that's what we mean by constriction and concealment. So we're going to try to understand this a little bit further. What exactly is that concealment? How does Hashem do that? And what does that mean? That concealment of consciousness. But before we do that, I want to just reflect on this, because I think that it's a really powerful thing to think about in a very human way. Right, we're talking here in a very esoteric way, but I think if we bring this concept down to our kind of most basic 2 feet on the ground, living in this world as human beings, I think it's a very powerful reflection, because so often we are, all of us, many of us, many people in the world are focusing on trying to create better selves, to actualize the best version of being ourselves that we possibly can. And we're looking to better our relationships, better our spirituality, better our work productivity, better ourselves in innumerable ways. But what we're being taught here by this opening stage of creation is that actually the process of creating your best self, the process of creating anything, comes first by pulling back in, not by doing more. It starts first by removing ourselves and making that space, that open space of potential, not by trying to just take on more and take on more and take on more, but sometimes first by being mitzamtzim, first by constricting and pulling back. On a very simple level, I think this is kind of easy to understand when it comes to relating and interacting with other people. Right? How often are issues and strifes and fights and arguments between people really the result of one person thinking that the other person needs to be just like them, needs to think the way they think, look the way they look, talk the way they talk? There's a well-known teaching in Pirkei Avos that says that one of the miracles in the Beis HaMikdash was that all the people would be gathered when everyone was there together, and there'd be omdim tzfufim u'mishtachavim revachim. Right? They would be standing and they would be packed in. There'd be no space. They'd be packed in, you know, squeezed together. And then they would bow and there would be plenty of space for everyone. Right? And I think that we usually hear this and we think the miracle that is being described is that, well, if we're standing and we're all so tight, well, then we shouldn't be able to bow at all. Right? We shouldn't have enough space to bow. And that is the miracle, but if you look carefully at the language, I think you'll notice that there's actually, possibly, if you read it very literally, there's a double miracle. Because I would have told you that if that's what the miracle was, if that's what was happening in the Beis HaMikdash, then it should have said that they were standing, squeezed together, and they were bowed, squeezed together. That's what the miracle was. It's not that when they bow, there's tons of open space. It's just that when they bow, they're able to bow. Right? Everyone follow that, right? Meaning when they're standing together, it's jam-packed. The fact that they can bow and it's still jam-packed, that's a miracle. But that's not what it says. It says they were standing squeezed together, and then when they would bow, there was revach, there was open space, mishtachavim revachim. And I think the teaching here is teaching us something so profound that's actually not a miracle. It's that in our lives, when we are always standing straight up, right? When people stand straight up, when it needs to be my way, right? This is the way things need to be. When I take that kind of stance, that type of posture, that this is the way things need to be, then it's very suffocating for everyone, including myself. It's claustrophobic. Now there's no space for anybody, right? It's tsefufim. When we're all omdim bimkoma, when we're all standing in our place, this is the way it needs to be. We're stuck in that. So then it's tsefuf for everyone. It's constricted for everybody. But when we can be mishtachave, when we can lower, when we can humble ourselves, when we can allow there to be space for other sorts of people, other sorts of ways of thinking, of being, when we can allow for there to be otherness, we can be mishtachave, then there's harvacha. Then it's mishtachavim rivachim. Then there's space for everybody. Allowing others to be who they are, which is really also a way of allowing myself to be who I am. And I think this is true for interacting with other people. I think it's true with interacting with our children. I think that one of the biggest challenges of parenting that I experience is how much how natural it is to the impulse of wanting to kind of live vicariously through your child, right? To project onto your child all the dreams that you didn't get to accomplish, or that you didn't get to see to fruition, or all the ways that you want things to be exactly. And in reality, our children are not our second chance at living all the things that we didn't get to live up to. That's not what our children are, right? They are they're more like an analogy that I heard from someone named Dr. Melissa Perrin that I loved is, our children are like books on loan that we're borrowing from the library, right? When you borrow a book from the library, you don't get to rip out pages. You don't get to rewrite the book. Your job is to read it and to learn from it and to take good care of it and make sure it doesn't get lost, make sure it doesn't get burned or thrown out, and then ultimately to return it in its pristine condition, appreciated and read and learned from. And that's, really easy to say, very, very difficult to do in the day-to-day. And with ourselves as well, right? In our lives, so often the challenges come from thinking that something should be one way, when really that's not the way it's meant to be. And that comes back to this concept of tzimtzum. So just kind of wrapping up there, that's kind of our first shlav, our first stage of what I wanted to share today, reflecting on tzimtzum, thinking about what exactly is tzimtzum and what exactly does this mean, this idea that it's not about physical space, of course, and why did there need to be tzimtzum? Because creation in Kabbalah is actually a process of emanation, and for there to be the possibility of consciousness, of otherness, of independence and individuality and multiplicity, Hashem needed to conceal the potency of the godly consciousness that would naturally come from all those emanations. And bringing this down to a kind of psychological, lived level as humans, thinking about how this concept of pulling ourselves back, instead of always doing more, instead of always trying to force ourselves into things, but sometimes being able to pull back to create that space for other people to have their own consciousness, whether it's people in our family, our children, people in our community, to allow them to have their own consciousness, or whether it's just the events and the things going on in our lives, to be able to sometimes, instead of trying to change them, sometimes being able to behold them. So now let's take a look on a level deeper of what this tzimtzum really means. So what does it mean that Hashem concealed? We explained so far why Hashem needed to conceal, kivyachol, why he needed to constrict and conceal himself, because again, otherwise there wouldn't be the possibility of anyone having their own independent individual consciousness. But what does it mean that Hashem concealed? So to explain this, we're going to be not reading inside, but basing everything I'm saying now on the Alter Rebbe in his teachings in Shar Yichud Ve'emuna, the Alter Rebbe of Chabad, of Shneur Zalman of Liadi, in Shar Yichud Ve'emuna. And he teaches there, based on the Pasuk, and something that we yell at the end, at the climax of Yom Kippur, Hashem Hu Ha'elokim. Hashem Hu Ha'elokim. Hard to translate, because it's Hashem is, God is God, right? But we have different terms for God. So Hashem Hu Alokim. What does this mean? What does this mean? So the Alter Rebbe explains that the names of Hashem, God has different names in Judaism, in the Torah. There's a name of Hashem and there's a name of Elohim. And they represent different things. The name of Hashem represents, so Yud Kei Vav Kei, represents and means Hashem's revealed presence. Hashem's, the emanations we've been talking about, how Hashem's light is emanated forward. That's the name of Hashem of Yud Kei Vav Kei. And then there's a name of Hashem, Elohim. And Elohim is the name of Hashem that has to do with tzimtzum, with concealment, with constriction, with Hashem not revealing but concealing. It's Hashem in his concealed mode, his concealed form. And what we're saying when we say Hashem Hu HaElokim is that Hashem in revelation is the same Hashem that is in concealment. Hashem Hu HaYudkei Vavkei Hu HaElokim. Right? That the name of Hashem, the experiences we have of God, in which we feel God, that God is clear, is sensible, that we experience godliness, that experience of God is the same God that we experience when we don't experience God, when we feel that we are not connected, when we feel that we can't feel or sense Hashem's presence. So the revealed God and the concealed God are really the same Hashem. Hashem Hu HaElokim. So what does this mean and how do we explain this? So here is what the Alter Rebbe in Shaar Yochev Emunah teaches. And I personally, to me, this is one of the most amazing teachings that I have come across and merited to try and understand a little bit of. What the Alter Rebbe explains is this. There is a really, really counterintuitive and absolutely paradoxical reality of godliness in this world. And what we're about to share here is very difficult to really believe, even if we understand it intellectually, because it's so counterintuitive to our experience. What the Alter Rebbe explains is this. Hashem in his essence, Hashem in his truest self, is Echad. Echad yachad miyuchad. Hashem is completely singular, completely and absolutely unique, totally and utterly transcendent, and unknowable. Hashem is completely other. Kadosh, kadosh, kadosh. Right? The Kuzari and many others explain. So it means Hashem is different, different, different. He is completely different, completely unique, completely unknowable, totally and absolutely singular and unique. In a way that is so transcendent to anything we can understand or possibly experience or sense or feel. So Hashem is totally other. In order for Hashem to become knowable, to become sensible, feelable, experienceable, means that Hashem is not appearing in his fullest and most absolute form. Because in his fullest and most absolute form, like we just said, he's completely unknowable, completely transcendent and unique. So the Alter Rebbe explains that the tzimtzum we talk about is actually not really tzimtzum. It's that Hashem revealed his absolute transcendent nature. Hashem began the process of emanations, began this revelation, this process of creation, by revealing his concealment. It's not actually an act of concealing. It's a revelation of concealment. It's that Hashem brought out in a forceful way, in a totally direct and potent way, how transcendent he is, how other he is, how unknowable he is. He brought out this essence of total otherness and unknowability, which to anyone on the other side experiencing that would be an experience of being disconnected from God, would be an experience of nothingness, because God in his total essence is for all intents and purposes, from our experience, is non-existent. Right? God in his true reality is actually, in a sense, speaking from a human perspective, non-existent. Because he's completely transcendent, completely other. This, in a sense, is what Rav Kook actually means when he says, there's a few different interpretations to this, but Rav Kook talks about how atheism is actually really emunah. Because the atheist is saying God doesn't exist. And he's absolutely right. From the human perspective, God in his truest sense doesn't exist. He doesn't exist in our... God in his essence doesn't exist. It's completely non-existent for us. It's completely unknowable. Completely other, singular, unique, transcendent. It doesn't exist in our world. So when God reveals that unknowable reality of God, that appears to be an act of concealment, when in reality what it is a revelation of God's highest self. It's a revelation of concealment. This is what sometimes, and I mentioned this at the end last week, someone had asked the question, I mentioned this just in passing, what's referred to in Kabbalah sometimes as butzina dekardinusa, which means the light of darkness, which is this earliest stage of creation. It's not that there's no light. It's not that it's a darkness. It's a light of darkness. Right? It's not a lack of light. It's not a lack of revelation. It's a revelation of concealment. It's not a lack of presence. It's the presence of lack. It's not that God is not there, right? God is there. But if God is really there, then there's no experience of him. So the absolute most powerful revelation of God is the concealment of God. So what this means, says the Alter Rebbe, is exactly what we say when we say Hashem Hu HaElokim. Right? That experience of Elokim, of a world which is Elokim, we know is Hateva, is nature. A world that doesn't seem godly, a world that seems just to be natural, that seems to have this independent, individualized consciousness that we spoke about in the beginning. Where does that consciousness we have of I am me, I'm not God, you are not God, I'm also not me, and you're also not, you're not me, and I'm not you, right? I think I mixed that up somewhere in there, but right? The how did that come to be? That how are we all not God if creation is a process of emanations? Is because the first emanation is the revelation of God's concealment. The first emanation is the emanation of God being so absolutely other that we don't experience him at all. It's the emanation of God being completely unknowable and completely transcendent. And I think this is really a massively important teaching in our lives, because we tend to think that when we feel Hashem's presence, we're connected. But then we have kind of lulls of silence, right? Where the transmitter just kind of, it's silent, quiet, where we feel disconnected from Hashem. But what the Alter Rebbe is teaching here is that actually, in a certain sense, it's the opposite. In a certain sense, it's the opposite. When we have in our lives moments that we don't feel godliness, it's because what we are experiencing is the highest revelation of godliness. The highest revelation of godliness is a revelation that you will not feel, because it's a revelation of God's concealment. It's a revelation of Kadosh, 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 of Hashem Echad, right, of Tzimtzum. It's a revelation of Hashem being unknowable. So by definition, you will not know it, you will not feel it. So the most potent revelations that come into your life are the ones that you don't feel, that you don't have any experience of. So it's that's why I said it's so counterintuitive. Right, because we're all looking to find inspiration, to feel Hashem, to feel connected, right, to be uplifted. And what we're learning here is actually, And I'll explain in a second how this fits into an actual, you know, to practically living and the fact that we are supposed to look for inspiration. But what we're learning about here is that actually the moments where we don't feel connected or inspired in any way, those are the moments that Hashem is actually most present in the most intense way. And because he is so present, we don't feel it at all, because it's not feelable, because it's the revelation of his total concealment. And this is why we find that Keser, right, the highest sphera, that sometimes is not even included in the spheros, right? People, you often say Chacham Abin Adas, right? But Keser, which is before, on the top, it's the crown, it's the part that's above the body, it's not even part of the body, is also sometimes called Ayin, right? Nothingness. Because that highest point is the point in where God's appearance is an appearance of absence. It's an appearance of nothingness. But that's also why the same word Ayin, those same letters, Aleph, Yud, and Nun, the bottom sphere, Malchus, is Ani, is also those same letters. Because it's the Ayin, Hashem's total concealment, that gives way for the possibility of us experiencing Ani, experiencing self, experiencing an independent existence. And it's in the experiences of independent existence, meaning where we don't feel that contingency on God, we don't feel that godly presence, that those Ani moments, that we're actually connected back to the top of the Ayin. Right? This is what the Maimar Chazal, we find in a number of different places, B'makom sha'ata motzei gedulaso shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu, in the place that you find the greatness of Hashem, Shama atamotzi anvisanuso, though that's the place that you also find his humility. Right? The greatest, most intense revelation of Hashem is the revelation of Hashem being Ayin, of being nothing, of not being felt. His humility. So, you know, the Alter Rebbe in a number of places outside of Shari Yichud V'Emunah, in Likutei Torah and Torah Or, talks about this in ways that he takes it even a step further, that really just becomes, it becomes so hard to grasp, because it, again, it's just so counterintuitive and so paradoxical. But it's well known, I think, that many people are familiar, the Nefesh HaChaim talks about this and many, many others, that the spiritual worlds and the physical world are mirror images of each other, right? So there's the world we live in, and there's a spiritual reality, and there's a mirroring of one to the other. But the way that the Alter Rebbe explains this is that mirroring of one another is actually the inverse of what you would probably expect. Because the way he explains it is that the highest point in the spiritual world is correlated, or is the mirroring, or is connected to the lowest point in our world. And the highest experiences in our world are the mirroring of the lowest point in the spiritual world. So actually, your body is rooted in a loftier place than your soul. Right? Breakfast this Tuesday morning is actually rooted in a higher place than Yom Kippur. Doing paperwork at your desk, right, is connected to a more spiritually elevated place than davening Shmoneh Esrei. Because everything is it's almost like a slingshot, right? The further back that you pull it before you let go, the further back you pull it is the further it will go, right? It'll go when you release, right? So when it lands 100 yards in front of you, the 100th yard, which part of the slingshot was that rooted in? It was rooted in the furthest point back, right? If you would have only pulled back a tiny bit, it would have gone 1 yard. So the 1 yard that it traversed is rooted in that small pullback, and then the 5 yards a little more, and then 10 yards a little more, 50 yards further back. The 100th yard line that it got to, that's because you pulled it all the way back. The highest point of this revelation is what gives way to the lowest point of what becomes actual, of the actualized revelation. So there's obviously a lot more to discuss with that, but if anyone wants a Mara Makom to look at, the place that I think this is spelled out in the most, again, the most explicitly counterintuitive way, because you might not be believing me that he actually says this, is in Likutei Torah Parshas Matos. So where he talks about the body is actually in a sense higher than the soul, and all the mundane experiences are actually higher than these sublime experiences. But let me just try and clarify this a little bit, because I don't want to leave it sounding so radical and kind of unbelievable. Everything we just spoke about is true when we're talking about Atzmus of Hashem, the essence of Hashem. But we don't live in that world. So we're not supposed to go looking to have ungodly experiences. We're not supposed to purposely, you might walk away from this and say, well, okay, so I shouldn't try and feel connected. I shouldn't try and feel inspired, because I should try and connect to a higher place of godliness, right? We don't live in a world where our job is to try and look for opportunities to connect to Atzmus of Hashem, to this essence of Hashem, to this unknowable Hashem. We live in a world where there is Giloi, Shefa, or there is revelation, there is emanations. And in the world of emanations, the hierarchies that we naturally or intuitively connect to are accurate. So everything we said now is counterintuitive, and it's true. But the intuitive experiences are also true. They're just true in different dimensions. So let me try and explain that, because I'm probably getting a little bit confusing. The intuitive experiences we have, where Yom Kippur is much holier than Tuesday morning breakfast, right? And davening Shemoneh Esrei is much holier than doing paperwork. Right, and being in the Kodesh HaKadoshim is much holier than walking down the street in West Rogers Park. Right, that natural intuitive experience, and that which we find in 99% of Torah that we learn that says that, is because that's within the realm of Giloi, in the realm of what is of Hashem having revealed Himself, and in the world of revelations, the Kodesh HaKadoshim is a higher level revelation than the street in Brooklyn. And in the world of revelation, Yom Kippur is a higher level of revelation than breakfast on Tuesday morning. Right? And when I'm davening Shemoneh Esrei, I'm connecting to a higher revelation than when I'm doing paperwork in my office. So all that intuitive experience and all that we find within halacha and Torah and sources, that's all true on this level of revelation. But what we're learning about here is that there's another level of connecting to Hashem that we're not necessarily supposed to be looking for intentionally. Because our work is in avoda within the world of Giloy, in the world of revelation. We're supposed to try and connect as much as possible to higher revelations. But if we switch tracks now, meaning we're leaving that world of revelation, and we switch tracks into the world that's called Atzmus, Hashem's essence, meaning not revelation. So actually, Hashem's essence is higher than even the highest revelation. What is Hashem's essence? Absolutely unknowable. So all the experiences that we have in our lives that don't feel any revelation are highest than the highest revelation. All those experiences that we don't feel connected at all is because what's actually going on in our lives is in that moment, it's a revelation of concealment. It's Atzmus, it's the essence of Hashem, it's the transcendent nature of Hashem, the unknowable nature of Hashem. And we're not supposed to go looking for those experiences, but Hashem is going to give us those experiences. They're going to happen. We're supposed to have those experiences. Even if we're not supposed to look for them, we're supposed to have those experiences. And our avoda is that when we have those experiences, we're supposed to be able to recognize and to bring the godliness into that which seems ungodly. Because we're supposed to recognize Hashem Hu HaLokim. Even this concealment, even this lack, is not a lack of presence. It's a presence of lack. This is a moment of kadosh, kadosh, kadosh. This is a moment, as Rabbi Nachman would say it, of ayeh. Right? In Tinyana, the famous Torah he has of ayeh. That's what it means, ayeh, to be able to be in a place that's totally ungodly and say, ayeh, where is Hashem? It's not a question we're looking for an answer to. That is the answer. The answer is to be able to say, where is Hashem? Is that it's an experience of Hashem not being here. That is Hashem's presence here. It's the absence that is the presence. So there are two different tracks to be on. They're not contradictory. And the intuitive track and the way that most of us live our lives, and 99% of what you'll find on the Lost Princess Initiative trying to inspire you, right? Trying to make you feel connected. That's working within the primary track that exists in the levels of Giloy. And within the levels of Hashem being revealed in this world, we are trying to access the experiences more and more and more of feeling that. But in our lives, we all know there's moments where we don't have that. And what this teaching is telling us is to realize that actually the moments you don't have that are because you've entered a completely different track, one that is totally counterintuitive, one that says that your body is actually higher than your soul. Your feelings of disconnection are actually more connected than your feelings of connection. So I mentioned this before, but I think this has a lot to do with what Cook says about atheism being emuna. Because the atheist is saying, I don't know God, I don't believe in God. And what he's really saying is God is completely unknowable. Right? To believe in God means that I'm saying there's something about God that I know, there's some sense of God, but God is actually truly ayeh, is truly ayin, is truly kadosh, 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 Hashem echad. So there's some level of emuna that is being captured in that doubt, in that rejection of faith. And I think that this, like I said, is just something so important to have an awareness of, because it just turns so much of our lives upside down in the way that we think about it. And again, it may not be the way that we're primarily supposed to be operating, but I think it's a fundamental piece of a consistent life of to live a consistent and lasting spiritual life. I think that this is such a fundamental principle, because it's so easy to feel in moments like, well, what happened to me? Like, where'd it go? I was inspired. Where'd it go? How do I live a spiritual life when every day is not, you know, another Fabrengen, or another, you know, I don't have as much time to learn, or I don't have as much time to daven in a concentrated way, or to meditate, or to do ispodidus, or I don't have as much ability to do chesed right now, and in other ways that I feel connected. But those moments of being disconnected, the moments that seem so ungodly, that seem so earthly, so mundane, to realize that those are not a lack of presence, they're a presence of the highest sense of God. So coming full circle to the story that I started with. So Rav Naftali of Rupshitz took this guy in and made him fast and give tzedakah and go to the mikvah and daven, and then he made him go to this secret place to get a key to another secret place, and to go off into the forest into another secret place, just to tell him that his pants were the cheapest ones in the market, and that's why he wears these pants. But on one level, maybe he's trying to teach him, like, you know, sometimes not everything has to be such a big deal. You can just be normal, right? Being normal is a very important teaching. But I think that, not in contradiction with that, but adding a layer to that, what he's also telling him is that actually the most mundane things, like, I got these pants because they were cheaper, the most simple and meaningless things are actually connected to the deepest, deepest secret in the world. So he needed to fast, and he needed to daven and to give tzedakah and to go to the mikvah and go to a secret place off the road and get a key and etc. Because hearing something as mundane, the fact that our world has such mundane things, right? That simplicity and earthliness of the world is actually rooted in the atzmus, is actually rooted in the deepest place, in the unknowable, transcendent nature of Hashem. And if anyone's interested in looking more into this, so again, I mentioned Shar Yichud Ve'Emunah, I mentioned Likutei Torah in Parshas Matos, but if anyone's looking for an English book that speaks more about this, there's a book published from Chabad by Rabbi Levin, or Levine, I'm not sure I pronounce his name, called Heaven on Earth. It's in English, and it collects and really does an amazing job of explaining this very, very counterintuitive reality in a very helpful way. So just another reading if for anyone who wants in English access to these concepts to look at further. So like last week, I'm going to end off with a little poem, and we'll have time for a question or two, and then we'll wrap up. So this poem is called, it's called A Place Called Nowhere. So difficult to believe, to internalize, that God is where he isn't, and where he is less. Come again? Yes, that's right. He is more where he is than where he is more where he isn't than where he is. Nothingness more real than somethingness. Yom Kippur, not as holy as breakfast this Tuesday. Davening Shmona Esrei, less godly than doing paperwork at my desk. Hanukkah candles, only a glimmer of turning off the light in my room. And feeling connected, not as much as feeling disconnected. I know, as I said, so difficult to believe. Such humility, do we have such humility? To let ourselves, others, and the world be. To let them be not in our image. Ayin, ani, I am I. So, if anyone has any questions, we have a couple of minutes. Yeah, Ami, you want to unmute yourself?
Hey, I read your book on the promo. It brings a different version of the story about the mikvah. Can't really speak my version, you didn't really speak about those other details.
Well, I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you. Can you say it again?
I have a book from Rabbi Shlomo Karlov. He brings that story, but he brings it a little bit differently. I don't remember.